Light on the Path by Mabel Collins. Comments, Part 2. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. The first four rules of Light on the Path are, undoubtedly curious though the statement may seem, the most important in the whole book, save only one. Why they are so important is that they contain the vital law, the very creative essence of the astral man. And it is only in the astral, or self-illuminated, consciousness that the rules which follow them have any living meaning. Once attained to the use of the astral senses, and it becomes a matter of course that one commences to use them, and the later rules are but guidance in their use. When I speak like this, I mean naturally that the first four rules are the only ones which are of importance and interest to those who read them in print upon a page. When they are engraved on the man's heart and on his life, unmistakably then the other rules become not merely interesting or extraordinary metaphysical statements, but actual facts in life which have to be grasped and experienced. The four rules stand written in the great chamber of every actual lodge of a living brotherhood. Whether the man is about to sell his soul to the devil like Faust, whether he is to be worsted in battle like Hamlet, or whether he is to pass on within the precincts, in any case these words are for him. The man can choose between virtue and vice, but not until he is a man, the babe or a wild animal cannot choose. Thus with the disciple, he must first become a disciple before he can even see the paths to choose between. This effort of creating himself as a disciple, the rebirth, he must do for himself without any teacher. Until the four rules are learned, no teacher can be of any use to him. And that is why the masters are referred to in the way they are. No real masters, whether adepts in power, in love, or in blackness, can affect a man till these four rules are passed. Tears, as I have said, may be called the moisture of life. The soul must have laid aside the emotions of humanity, must have secured a balance which cannot be shaken by misfortune, before its eyes can open upon the superhuman world. The voice of the masters is always in the world, but only those hear it whose ears are no longer receptive of the sounds which affect the personal life. Laughter no longer lightens the heart, anger may no longer enrage it, tender words bring it no balm. For that within, to which the ears are as an outer gateway, is an unshaken place of peace in itself, which no person can disturb. As the eyes are the windows of the soul, so are the ears its gateways or doors. Through them comes knowledge of the confusion of the world. The great ones who have conquered life, who have become more than disciples, stand at peace and undisturbed amid the vibrations and kaleidoscopic movements of humanity. They hold within themselves a certain knowledge, as well as a perfect peace. And thus they are not roused or excited by the partial and erroneous fragments of information which are brought to their ears by the changing voices of those around them. When I speak of knowledge, I mean intuitive knowledge. This certain information can never be obtained by hard work or by experiment. For these methods are only applicable to matter, and matter is in itself a perfectly uncertain substance, continually affected by change. The most absolute and universal laws of natural and physical life, as understood by the scientist, will pass away when the life of this universe has passed away, and only its soul is left in the silence. What then will be the value of the knowledge of its laws acquired by industry and observation? I pray that no reader or critic will imagine that by what I have said I intend to depreciate or disparage acquired knowledge, or the work of scientists. On the contrary, I hold that scientific men are the pioneers of modern thought. The days of literature and of art, when poets and sculptors saw the divine light and put it into their own great language. These days lie buried in the long past, with the antiphidian sculptures and pre-Homeric poets. The mysteries no longer rule the world of thought and beauty. Human life is the governing power, not that which lies beyond it. But the scientific workers are progressing, not so much by their own will as by sheer force of circumstances, towards the far line which divides things interpretable from things uninterpretable. Every fresh discovery drives them a step onward. Therefore do I very highly esteem the knowledge obtained by work and experiment. But intuitive knowledge is an entirely different thing. It is not acquired in any way, but is, so to speak, a faculty of the soul. Not the animal soul, that which becomes a ghost after death, when lust or liking or the memory of ill deeds holds it to the neighborhood of human beings, but the divine soul, which animates all the external forms of the individualized being. This is, of course, a faculty which indwells in that soul, which is inherent. The would-be disciple has to arouse himself to the consciousness of it by a fierce and resolute and indomitable effort of will. I use the word indomitable for a special reason. Only he who is untamable, who cannot be dominated, who knows he has to play the Lord over men, over facts, over all things save his own divinity, can arouse this faculty. With faith all things are possible. The skeptical laugh at faith and pride themselves on its absence from their own minds. The truth is that faith is a great engine, an enormous power, which in fact can accomplish all things. For it is the covenant or engagement between man's divine part and his lesser self. The use of this engine is quite necessary in order to obtain intuitive knowledge. For unless a man believes such knowledge exists within himself, how can he claim to use it? Without it, he is more helpless than any driftwood or wreckage on the great tides of the ocean. They are cast hither and thither indeed, so may a man be by the chances of fortune. But such adventures are purely external and of very small account. A slave may be dragged through the streets in chains, and yet retain the quiet soul of a philosopher, as was well seen in the person of Epictetus. A man may have every worldly prize in his possession, and stand absolute master of his personal fate to all appearance, and yet he knows no peace, no certainty, because he is shaken within himself by every tide of thought that he touches on. And these changing tides do not merely sweep the man bodily hither and thither like driftwood on the water. That would be nothing. They enter into the gateways of his soul, and wash over that soul, and make it blind and blank and void of all permanent intelligence, so that passing impressions affect it. To make my meaning plainer, I will use an illustration. Take an author at his writing, a painter at his canvas, a composer listening to the melodies that dawn upon his glad imagination. Let any one of these workers pass his daily hours by a wide window looking on a busy street. The power of animating life blinds sight and hearing alike, and the great traffic of the city goes by like nothing but a passing pageant. But a man whose mind is empty, whose day is objectless, sitting at the same window, notes the passers-by and remembers the faces that chance to please or interest him. So it is with the mind in its relation to eternal truth. If it no longer transmits its fluctuations, its partial knowledge, its unreliable information to the soul, then, in the inner place of peace already found when the first rule has been learned, in that inner place there leaps into flame the light of actual knowledge. Then the ears begin to hear, very dimly, very faintly at first. And, indeed, so faintly and tender are those first indications of the commencement of true actual life, that they are sometimes pushed aside as mere fancies, mere imaginings. but before these are capable of becoming more than mere imaginings, the abyss of nothingness has to be faced in another form. The utter silence, which can only come by closing the ears to all transitory sounds, comes as a more appalling horror than even the formless emptiness of space. Our only mental conception of blank space is, I think, when reduced to its barest element of thought, that of black darkness. This is a great physical terror to most persons, and when regarded as an eternal and unchangeable fact, must mean to the mind the idea of annihilation rather than anything else. But it is the obliteration of one sense only, and the sound of a voice may come and bring comfort even in the profoundest darkness. The disciple, having found his way into this blackness, which is the fearful abyss, must then so shut the gates of his soul that no comforter can enter there, nor any enemy. And it is in making the second effort that the fact of pain and pleasure being but one sensation becomes recognizable by those who have before been unable to perceive it. For when the solitude of silence is reached, the soul hungers so fiercely and passionately for some sensation on which to rest, that a painful one would be as keenly welcomed as a pleasant one. When this consciousness is reached, the courageous man, by seizing and retaining it, may destroy the sensitiveness at once. When the ear no longer discriminates between that which is pleasant or that which is painful, it will no longer be affected by the voices of others, and then it is safe and possible to open the doors of the soul. Sight is the first effort, and the easiest, because it is accomplished partly by an intellectual effort. The intellect can conquer the heart, as is well known in ordinary life. Therefore, this preliminary step still lies within the dominion of matter. But the second step allows of no such assistance, nor of any material aid whatever. Of course, I mean by material aid the action of the brain, or emotions, or human soul. In compelling the ears to listen only to the eternal silence, the being we call man becomes something which is no longer man. A very superficial survey of the thousand and one influences which are brought to bear on us by others will show that this must be so. A disciple will fulfill all the duties of his manhood, but he will fulfill them according to his own sense of right, and not according to that of any person or body of persons. This is a very evident result of following the creed of knowledge instead of any of the blind creeds. To obtain the pure silence necessary for the disciple, the heart and emotions, the brain and its intellectualisms have to be put aside. Both are but mechanisms which will perish with the span of man's life. It is the essence beyond, that which is the motive power and makes man live, that is now compelled to rouse itself and act. Now is the greatest hour of danger. In the first trial men go mad with fear. Of this first trial Bulwer Lytton wrote. No novelist has followed to the second trial, though some of the poets have. Its subtlety and great danger lies in the fact that in the measure of a man's strength is the measure of his chance of passing beyond it or coping with it at all. If he has power enough to awaken that unaccustomed part of himself, the supreme essence, then has he the power to lift the gates of gold. Then is he the true alchemist in possession of the elixir of life. It is at this point of experience that the occultist becomes separated from all other men and enters on to a life which is his own, on to the path of individual accomplishment, instead of mere obedience to the genii which rule our earth. This raising of himself into an individual power does in reality identify him with the nobler forces of life and make him one with them. For they stand beyond the powers of this earth and the laws of this universe. Here lies man's only hope of success in the great effort. To leap right away from his present standpoint to his next and at once become an intrinsic part of the divine power, as he has been an intrinsic part of the intellectual power of the great nature to which he belongs. He stands always in advance of himself, if such a contradiction can be understood. It is the men who adhere to this position, who believe in their innate power of progress, and that of the whole race, who are the elder brothers, the pioneers. Each man has to accomplish the great leap for himself and without aid. Yet it is something of a staff to lean on to know that others have gone on that road. It is possible that they have been lost in the abyss. No matter. They have had the courage to enter it. Why I say that it is possible they have been lost in the abyss is because of this fact, that one who has passed through is unrecognizable until the other and altogether new condition is attained by both. It is unnecessary to enter upon the subject of what that condition is at the present. I only say this, that in the early state in which man is entering upon the silence, he loses knowledge of his friends, of his lovers, of all who have been near and dear to him, and also loses sight of his teachers and of those who have preceded him on his way. I explain this because scarce one passes through without bitter complaint. Could but the mind grasp beforehand that the silence must be complete, surely this complaint need not arise as a hindrance on the path. Your teacher or your predecessor may hold your hand in this and give you the utmost sympathy a human heart is capable of. But when the silence and the darkness come, you lose all knowledge of him. You are alone, and he cannot help you, not because his power is gone, but because you have evoked your great enemy. By your great enemy, I mean yourself. If you have the power to face your own soul in the darkness and silence, you will have conquered the physical or animal self which dwells in sensation only. This statement, I feel, will appear involved, but in reality it is quite simple. Man, when he has reached his fruition and civilization is at its height, stands between two fires. Could he but claim his great inheritance, the encumbrance of the mere animal life would fall away from him without difficulty. But he does not do this, and so the races of men flower and then droop and die and decay off the face of the earth, however splendid the bloom may have been. And it is left to the individual to make this great effort, to refuse to be terrified by his greater nature, to refuse to be drawn back by his lesser or more material self. Every individual who accomplishes this is a redeemer of the race. He may not blazon forth his deeds, he may dwell in secret and silence, but it is a fact that he forms a link between man and his divine part, between the known and the unknown, between the stir of the marketplace and the stillness of the snow-capped Himalayas. He has not to go about among men in order to form this link. In the astral he is that link, and this fact makes him a being of another order from the rest of mankind. Even so early on the road toward knowledge, when he has but taken the second step, he finds his footing more certain, and becomes conscious that he is a recognized part of a whole. This is one of the contradictions in life which occur so constantly that they afford fuel to the fiction writer. The occultist finds them become much more marked as he endeavors to live the life he has chosen. As he retreats within himself and becomes self-dependent, he finds himself more definitely becoming part of a great tide of definite thought and feeling. When he has learned the first lesson, conquered the hunger of the heart, and refuse to live on the love of others, he finds himself more capable of inspiring love. As he flings life away, it comes to him in a new form and with new meaning. The world has always been a place with many contradictions in it, to man. When he becomes a disciple, he finds life as describable as a series of paradoxes. This is a fact in nature, and the reason for it is intelligible enough. Man's soul dwells like a star apart, even that of the vilest among us. while his consciousness is under the law of vibratory and sensuous life. This alone is enough to cause those complications of character which are the material for the novelist. Every man is a mystery to a friend and enemy alike, and to himself. His motives are often undiscoverable, and he cannot probe to them or know why he does this or that. The disciple's effort is that of awakening consciousness in this starry part of himself, where his power and divinity lie sleeping. As this consciousness becomes awakened, the contradictions in the man himself become more marked than ever, and so do the paradoxes which he lives through. For, of course, man creates his own life, and adventures are to the adventurous, is one of those wise proverbs which are drawn from actual fact and cover the whole area of human experience. Pressure on the divine part of man reacts upon the animal part. As the silent soul awakes, it makes the ordinary life of man more purposeful, more vital, more real and responsible. To keep to the instances already mentioned, the occultist who has withdrawn into his own citadel and found strength, immediately he becomes aware of the demands of duty upon him. He does not obtain his strength by his own right, but because he is part of a whole, and as soon as he is safe from the vibration of life and can stand unshaken, the outer world cries out to him to come and labor in it. So with the heart. When it no longer wishes to take, it is called upon to give abundantly. Light on the Path has been called a book of paradoxes, and very justly. What else could it be when it deals with the actual personal experience of the disciple? To have acquired the astral senses of sight and hearing, or in other words, to have attained perception and opened the doors of the soul, are gigantic tasks, and may take the sacrifice of many successive incarnations. And yet, when the will has reached its strength, the whole miracle may be worked in a second of time. Then is the disciple the servant of time no longer. These two first steps are negative, that is to say, they imply retreat from a present condition of things rather than advance towards another. The next two are active, implying the advance into another state of being.